to me the challenge that we have before us. And I have to say that there's I have a concern. I'm just going to lay it out to you right away. That the concern that I have is that we forget why we're here. That we forget our mission. We are given a mission. We're given a mission to take what we have been granted and to share it with others. It has always been interesting to me that I've always thought maybe God could have done a better job if he had just sent a whole band of angels down around the world and said, boo, how about you obey the gospel? I'm an angel. And we might just get a whole bunch of folks that way. But we'd probably get folks who were impressed with the angel and not impressed with God. Instead, God has chosen to use fallible, weak, scared people like you and me in order to present the most beautiful and precious and valuable treasure that could ever be. And that way, folks will be impressed with the treasure and not with the one who's carrying the treasure. And that's what it's about. I hope we don't forget our mission. It's easy to come into a nice building like here and other places where brethren worship, to enjoy one another, to enjoy our relationship with one another, and forget that we have a mission. And we must not forget our mission. All my lessons are going to be about how to, except for tonight. Tonight we're going to talk about trust. We're talking about how to trust God. And to me, this is the most important of all. You ever noticed when you look at the text in Matthew 28 and verse 19 and 20 concerning Jesus' command to go out and to the apostles, to go into all the world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to do all the things I've commanded you. Have you ever thought about what it was like to be the 11 at that particular point, but to be the apostles at that particular juncture and to hear what he had to say there? Okay, you're a plain old fisherman, or you're a zealot or a tax collector, but mostly you're a bunch of people that the Sanhedrin Council referred to as ignorant and unlearned men. And there's just 11 of you, and Jesus just said, I want you to convert the whole world. I believe I'd have freaked out. What about you? Oh, by the way, I'm leaving. I'm heading back to heaven. Well, you guys go out, and I want you just to make disciples of all nations. You just go for it. It blows my mind that Jesus chose these fellas to be his representatives. They are not notable people. In fact, on the day of Pentecost, what was the reaction even of the Jews in Jerusalem? What, are not all these who speak Galileans? Folks, that was not a good term. That was not a complimentary statement. What? How did the Lord choose such individuals? And if I place myself in their position and to have to go out and make disciples of a Roman world, much less a Jewish world that is bent in their Judaism in 1,500 years of history, but to go out to a Roman world and convert pagans who had no understanding whatsoever of one true God is indeed a formidable task. How would you have felt? Well, it would have been intimidating all the way up until these last words that Jesus uttered. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. Oh, that's an entirely different matter. What Jesus had done up to this point was teach his apostles the importance of trusting him, and that when he was with them, this was actually going to be accomplished. And there wasn't any way that their insufficiencies, that their inabilities, or their lack of resources, or any of these things was going to stop this from happening, because, lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. I'd like you to step back and take a moment to take a look at a text. We're going to start in the fourth chapter of the book of Acts. Excuse me, the book of Mark. And I'd like you to take a look in Mark chapter 4, and I want you to see a little bit about the progress which Jesus made in trying to get these apostles in a position where they would be able to go out and do what the Lord had said. In chapter 4 and verse 35, we're going to begin reading. On the same day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Now, this is a unique scene, because these fellows, I mean, especially Peter and Andrew and James and John, are quite capable fishermen and have been on the Sea of Galilee a number of times, obviously. And they would be very comfortable in the sea. They've done it a lot. Jesus, being tired, goes down in the stern of the boat and just falls sound asleep. I have to say, I'm a little amazed at his ability to sleep through such a storm, but I suppose it was just rocking him along, and that had been fine. I'd have had to grab the Dramamine. But he's good with it, and he is sound asleep. Now, just imagine what's going on deck. I mean, these guys are frantic. They have been in a lot of windstorms on the Sea of Galilee, no doubt. But in this particular storm, this is something they had never faced before. The boat is filling and they can't chuck the water out fast enough. They're going down and they know it. Now Matthew, he's a tax collector. He's probably yelling at them, "Why don't you get Jesus up? You know, well, we can handle it. We can handle it. We're fishermen." Finally, they give up all hope, rouse him up. "Teacher, don't you understand? We're about to drown." And he stands up and he talks to the wind and the sea as if they were unruly children. "Stop it!" Calm. Wow. I like that. I want to see the video on that when I get there. Wow. Just boom. Calm. Wow. And he turns to the apostles and he says, "What is the matter with you? Where is your faith?" It's almost like saying, "Do you actually believe the boat is going down with me in it? Get a clue. I'm in the boat. It's not going anywhere. Where's your faith?" You know, when you're on a journey for the Lord, there's going to be unimaginable obstacles. There's going to be all kinds of things that are going to come up. When we're in service of the Lord, there's no doubt there will be obstacles that will come that you can't even imagine. I just look at the days of Nehemiah, when Nehemiah went to try to urge those people to build the walls. And you read the first six chapters of Nehemiah and you see every imaginable obstacle that comes along. I love Nehemiah's attitude. I think I might have given up. You finally just go, "Oh, forget it." But Nehemiah, everything that came up, he'd pray to God and say, "Give me another brick. I don't care what happened." You know, we're not like that a lot of times. when we run into difficulties in trying to do the Lord's work, no matter what it is, evangelism or otherwise, if we run into some tough times, we kind of decide, you know, this probably isn't, it probably wasn't a good idea. You ever notice we do that? This probably isn't working real well. It's probably not a very good idea. No, wait a minute. Just because something becomes difficult when we're trying to accomplish what God has said to do, just because there's difficulties doesn't mean it was the wrong thing to do. There's all kinds of great things that were done in the Bible, I mean like delivering Israel out of Egypt, that had some challenges. And if they had given up, which they tried to a few times, but the obstacles were not the reason to give up. It is interesting to see how these individuals face this and what Jesus said. The power of the Lord is with you. When we go out into a lost world, we've got to have the trust and the confidence of the statement, "Lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the world." The Lord is with us. And we have to have that kind of trust. Look at the next text. We go over to chapter 6. Chapter 6 of Mark and verse 7. Notice the section there. Beginning at verse 7, he called the 12 to himself and began to send them out two by two and gave them power over unclean spirits. He commanded them to take nothing for the journey except for a staff, no bag, no bread, no copper in their money belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. And also he said to them, "In whatever place you enter a house, stay there till you depart from that place. And whoever will not receive you nor hear you when you depart from there, shake off the dust under your feet as a testimony against them. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city." So they went out and preached that the people should repent. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. Now, we know that is the limited commission. Sometimes we read it and we go, "Yeah, okay, so what?" Hey, again, put yourself in that position. All right, I want you to go out and travel all this distance and all this. And by the way, don't bring any money. Don't bring an extra change of clothes. Don't bring any of this kind of stuff. Just wear a pair of sandals and go. I want you to travel light and travel quick. And when you enter a city, just find somebody who's worthy and they'll take care of you. Would you do that? What? It just seems a little unreasonable, doesn't it? Sometimes they're just commands that you go, "What? You actually want me to do it that way?" Yeah, trust me. You know, that isn't it interesting? That's always been the case with how God has wanted His people to operate as far as taking care of those who are working full-time as opposed to what most of us do is working part-time in the kingdom. You know, the Levites and the priests in the Old Testament, God wanted them to be taken care of by the rest of Israel because that connected them with God's work and because it was important that they were connected. And it's the same way today. But here Jesus does the same thing. No, you could have taken money. I don't want you to. I want you to connect with these other people and I want you to trust my way and my plan is going to work. And so trust my plan. It's actually going to happen the way I said. You're going to be able to be taken care of. Well, I've known preachers who've said, "Oh, no, I wouldn't trust the brethren to support me. I just wouldn't trust them." Really? I got a higher opinion of brethren than that. I don't think that's true. I've always found it not to be true. Because brethren love the Lord and they love what God wants them to do, and they love the preaching and spreading of the gospel as they do it and as they support others who do it. And that was God's plan. But the important part here was trusting God's plan and letting that happen that way. Let's go to the next text. Take a look in the 6th chapter of Mark and verse 30. Mark 6 and verse 30. And notice here in this passage, "Then the apostles gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said to them, 'Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while.' For there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. So they departed to a deserted place in a boat by themselves. But the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep, not having a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. When the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and already the hour is late. Send them away that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat." But he answered and said to them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat?" But he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they found out, they said, "Five and two fish." Then he commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks in hundreds and in fifties. And when he had taken the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed, and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the two fish he divided among them all. So they all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fish. Now those who had eaten the loaves were about 5,000 men. Been a Christian very long, you've read that passage many times, you've seen that. But think about what Jesus is doing with his apostles here. He takes them aside to a deserted place. You need some rest. Of course, here they are in the boat. Can you picture it? Get inside the boat with them, and here you are coming to shore. You've been looking forward to this break that Jesus has offered you, and you're headed toward the shore, and you look your eyes up, and you go, "Oh, they beat us around. They're all here." I have to admit, I probably would have said, "Folks, you know, I really appreciate this, but we're taking a few days off. You know, just we'll be back. Go on your way." Not Jesus. No, he had compassion. And he taught them. And as the day became spent, the apostles come to Jesus and say, "Look, you need to send them away, you know, so that they can have some place to eat." I don't know whether they were thinking about themselves or the multitude more, but we need to send them away. And notice what Jesus says. He says, "You give them something to eat." Now, John's account gives us a lot more details on this. And John's account says, Philip, you know, he must have been the accountant among them. He gets on his calculator and he goes, "Wait a minute. 200 denarii wouldn't be enough to feed this multitude even a little bit." And Jesus says, "What do you have?" Notice that. What do you have? Go find out. John's account says they find a kid who brought his lunch. Five loaves and two fish. Now, a loaf is not like, you know, a loaf like we get in the store. Five loaves, you know, it's kind of like little pancakes almost. And they got two anchovies or something. And they go, "Well, we swiped this kid's lunch. And here, you know, this is what we've got." Jesus says, "Make everybody sit down. We're having lunch. We're having dinner." I really want to ask Peter, what were you thinking at that moment? And especially when he started praying and giving thanks for it. I'm just seeing Peter poke Andrew. What is he doing? We've got five loaves and two fish. And then he starts handing it out. And handing it out. Until all are fed. You know, the question wasn't, "Can you do it?" He said, "Feed them." When you think that all of your resources are gone, when you think you do not have the ability, when you think you do not have enough, forgetting who is the provider, who can deliver. He can do what we cannot do. He said, "You feed them." How are we going to do that? What do you have? I didn't ask you, you know, to go out and buy 200 denarii worth of bread. I said, "What do you have?" "Well, we just got five loaves and two fish." "I'll work with that. What do you have?" "I don't have much." When I think of talents, when I think of ability, all that, I have people sometimes say, oh, Barry, you know, you have this really great gift of doing evangelism." I do not. And I'm not trying to be self-deprecating here. I do not. I'm scared to death to talk to people. I'm a very inside, a quite shy kind of person. It's taken me years to overcome that. If you talk to kids in high school that I went to school with, they wouldn't believe I'm doing what I'm doing now, because they'd say, you never hardly said 2 cents. I would sit in a whole class for a whole semester and not say a word. I know what it's like to be afraid. But that's not what I'm counting on. Because it isn't my talent that's going to make anything happen. It's God's. God has the power. God has the resources. He took 12 men who were simple, unlearned, plain old folks, as plain as they could be. And he used them to convert the world. You and I have got just as much going for us as they did, and more. And we forget that sometimes. Look at one more text. Take a look over in chapter 6, down in verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. Now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. Then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. Now about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea, and would have passed by them. And when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost and cried out. For they all saw him and were troubled. But immediately he talked with them and said to them, be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased, and they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled, for they had not understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened. This is a unique scene. Again, John's account gives us a lot more details about it. After he fed the 5,000, the people decided this guy would make a great king, and they were going to make him a king by force. It is possible, at least, that the apostles were really in on this and saying, yeah, great idea. Jesus very abruptly, and that's kind of interesting, in both accounts, he's very abrupt, and immediately he tells the apostles, get in the boat, go to the other side. He dismisses the multitude, and he goes up on the mountain and he prays. You see the abruptness? You get the very distinct feeling he is not happy with what is going on there, with how they had received the feeding that he had done. Get in the boat, go to the other side, told the multitude, we're done. He goes on the mountain and he prays. Interesting scene. The apostles get in the boat and they take off. They get about halfway across the sea and a windstorm comes up. The sea is depending on where they were crossing, 6 to 8 miles across, and they're about halfway, 3 to 4 miles, and the wind comes up and they are straining at rowing and cannot go any further. Jesus, at the evening, somehow from the mountaintop, looks out and sees them straining at rowing. I kind of think that's interesting. He sees them straining at rowing, but he doesn't go to them. He goes ahead and prays. And he prays all the way till whatever the fourth watch of the night is, 3 or 4 in the morning. He just prays most of the night. And then he decides, okay, it's time. And he starts going to them, and he's just walking on the water, and he's going to cruise right on by them. I got to ask him when I get there, why were you going to walk by? Well, he's just going on by. Why row? Why row when you walk? He's just going on by. And all of a sudden they see him and they scream out like a bunch of little girls. Whoa, you know, what is this? and he says, oh, it's just me. I'm just taking a stroll here, you know, across the sea. I could see it's hard to row. And so he comes to him, he steps in the boat. And again, the account says in Matthew, they're immediately at shore. And everything, the wind ceased and everything. You know, I think it's interesting about that. First, I'm impressed with the disciples. He said, go to the other side, and it didn't matter if they had to row all night. They were determined to go to the other side. They kept right on rowing. I think I'd have just said, oh, guys, Let's just sit here until the wind quits. Even if it blows us back to the shore. I'm done. I'm tired. Nope. They were rowing. They weren't getting anywhere, but they were rowing. And when Jesus came and they screamed out and he got in the boat, boom, they got to the other side. Isn't that interesting? Again, lesson learned. Understand something. When you've seemingly used all your strength, do you trust Jesus to take you the rest of the way? Do you trust him to take care of it from there on? You see, each one of these scenes had the same kind of message to them. You have to count on me. You have to look to me. If you're going to accomplish the things that I'm going to send you out to do, it isn't a matter of your strength. It isn't a matter of your resources. It isn't a matter of what you have the ability to contribute. It has to do with the power that Jesus was giving. Lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the world. The last things he said to them, I'm going to be with you, had to comfort them and cause them to understand they could go out on this mission and truly accomplish what he had told them to do, regardless of their own abilities or their own resources. It is the exact same thing for us today. You know how I know that? Because that's the way it has always been with God. It has never been any different with God. I love the story back in 1 Samuel chapter 13 and 14. You may remember it. But in 1 Samuel 13, toward the end, we have this the situation where Saul is king. And you know Saul had been foolish. And here he is, king, and he is going to go to battle against the Philistines. Do you know how many men he has in his army? He has 600 men in his army. I don't know. That's just crazy. We know a few years later by texting the kings that Israel was able to muster 800,000 people just in the northern part of the kingdom, much less the south. He has 600 men. But of course, reading a little more carefully, you find out why. There are no swords and no spears in all the land. Only Jonathan and only Saul have a sword. The Philistines won't let blacksmiths come in the land. They've taken them all out. They won't let anybody sharpen a sword. And so here they are going against the mighty Philistines, and no one has a sword except Jonathan and except Saul. And the beginning of chapter 14, Jonathan turns to his armor bearer and he says, hey, let's just go up and see what we can do with these Philistines. And what is really amazing is to look at chapter 14 of 1 Samuel and look down at verse 6. It says, then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. Jonathan's faith is just amazing. Jonathan says, look, it isn't about us. Because the Lord doesn't care if there's a whole bunch or there's few. He can save with many or few. It doesn't matter. He said, let's go up. You know who I love as much as Jonathan? It's the armor bearer. The armor bearer goes, you bet, dude. Let's go. You whack them and I'll kill them. You knock them down and I'll finish them off. And so Jonathan says, well, here's the plan. We're going to go up and we're going to peek over the edge of the cliff and we're going to say, yoo-hoo, you Philistines. And if they say, come on, and we'll show you something, we'll say, well, the Lord's delivered them into our hand. Let's go get them. And so Jonathan, the armor bearer, crawl up on the hands and knees, and they'll go, yoo-hoo, you Philistines. The Philistines go, ho, ho, look at the old Israelites, bunch of rabbits climbing out of their holes. Come on up here. And Jonathan says, we got them. And he goes out and he whacks 20 of them down. The armor bearer finishes them off in a matter of a half acre and sends the entire Philistine army to flight. Oh, that, you know how that happened? It's because Jonathan was so good with a sword. No, it wasn't. It was because God was with them. That's how it happened. God's always done it that way. Have you ever seen it any different? Think of the people God has used to fulfill His will. Oh, they were just great men. Not until he called them. In fact, the ones who appeared great became nothing. And the ones who were nothing became great. That's the way it's always been with God. That's the beauty of it. Nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or few. You can think about Moses. You know, here God says, Moses, I want you to go in and deliver him out. And he says, me? Why don't you send somebody else? And he says, no. I'll be with you. Notice what he says? I'll be with you. And he says, well, you know, I don't speak very well with my tongue. And he says, no, I'll be with your mouth. It's okay. I'll be with your mouth. And he says, well, you know, I'm still don't think I can do it. He says, look, I'll send Aaron and I'll be with your mouth and his mouth. You see what God's doing? He's taking somebody who was afraid, who had resigned himself at 80 years old just to finish out his life chasing sheep around. And God made him the greatest deliverer in all of history. Amazing. You remember the story in Numbers chapter 11? Remember when the Israelites murmured because they were tired eating manna? I eat this manna every day. And they said, we don't want meat. Remember what God said? He says, I think it's funny, I always remind me about something my mother would say. He says, Moses, I'm going to give them meat to eat, but I'm not going to give it to them 1 day, 2 days, 10 days, or 20 days. I'm going to give it to them a whole month till it comes out their nose. That sounds like my mother. You know, she'd say, you want this? I'll tell you. I'm going to give it to you for a whole month. And remember what Moses says? Moses says, Lord, what are you going to do? Kill all the sheep and cattle in the whole wilderness? And in order to feed these people? Why, you can't do that. And God's answer is, has the Lord's arm been shortened? You know, I got little alligator arms or something. You think I don't have any power? Has the Lord's arm been shortened? Now you will see what I say will happen to you or not. Now you will see. And he brought quail about 3 feet deep for 20 miles around. Just hovering around for you to go up and bop them on the head. Didn't even need a shotgun. Way to go. All you could eat. Has the Lord's arm been shortened? Is that any more true today? Has the Lord's arm been shortened? I grew up in a culture in which I wish I had a dollar for every time some brother or sister said, oh, you can't teach anybody anymore. Or you can't teach that person there, fill in the blank. Some belief, some whatever. You can't teach them their this. I've heard it before I went to Nashville. Before I moved to Brentwood, I had people tell me, you can't teach people in Nashville. They're all too religious. Everybody goes to a church. You won't be able to get a class. That has not been true. In six short months, the brethren at Nashville in the Brentwood Church have set up class after class after class for us to teach people. I have nearly every night filled next week to teach classes that brethren have set up with friends and acquaintances that they have asked if they would like to study. It has not been true. It has never been true. What did Jesus say? Lift up your eyes. The fields are white unto harvest. Indeed, it is. There are seekers out there. Do you know it's better than it's ever been? You say, what? It's better than it's ever been. You know why? Because even the people who have somewhat of a religious background are losing it. There's no commitment anymore. Now they're losing it. There's no knowledge of God anymore. Do you realize I have taught 3 or 4 people in the past 6 months who didn't know where Genesis was, who had no idea what Matthew was, that the books of the New Testament or the Old Testament were as foreign to them as the Book of Mormon is to you. They didn't know. Why? Because our country is losing the knowledge of God. And with every moment that goes by that they lose it, you and I have an advantage to bring it to them. Because they're empty inside. And they're lost. And they're like sheep without a shepherd. And all we have to do is ask. Would you like to study? Would you like to read the Bible? My sister Becky. She was telling some of the ladies at church one day. She says, you know, I just was so excited. I've got a class with this lady over here on this block, and this lady, and she listed every day, Monday through Friday, I have a class with a different woman. And the ladies of the church looked at her and said, Becky, how did you do that? And she went, I asked. If you knew my sister Becky, you know she's kind of an airhead, you know what I'm saying? I ask. She's blonde. I ask. She didn't know any better. She just asked. No. Don't think that way. It isn't true. And I'm so happy to know that there's people out there that little old you and me can say, how would you like to get together and read the Bible? Let's learn together. Let's study and see what God has to say. You'd be amazed at the answer. But you know, what about how we handle these things? Look at your own life for a second. What has the Lord given you that seems too big for you? You know, it may not be in the area of evangelism, though that's a big one. It could be in any area. What has the Lord given you that seems too big for you? Well, maybe it's some kind of sin that you're having a difficulty overcoming, and you're letting it conquer you. The Lord can help you conquer it. Maybe it's that you're stagnating your growth. There's a lady in the church at Brentwood named Kim. Kim came to me a few weeks ago and she says, I'm tired of just coming to church and going to a Bible class and not doing anything with it. My neighbor has cancer and it's very possible she's going to die. She's under serious radiation and chemo. She's lost all of her hair. She's sick constantly. I've gone over and tried to make a connection with her. We're connecting. I'm trying to help her. I want to teach her the Bible, but I haven't the slightest idea what to do. I said, well, let's sit down, you and me, and we'll read Mark together, and I'll show you how I would teach her by how I would teach you, and then you pass it on to her. She says, I'm scared. I said, so would I. I said, so what? God will be with you and you can do it. I'm not sure how old Kim is, probably 38, 40, something like that. She had her first class last week. She texted me. It went great. She's looking forward to the second. Wonderful. Wow. You can overcome because God's with you. Because you can trust in a power greater than yourself. And you have a word that is powerful and can crack the hardest of hearts. You might be stagnating your growth. You might need to take the first step to be evangelistic, which is just simply not passing by without making a friend to somebody that you don't know yet. Expanding your circle of friends. The question isn't your strength. The question isn't your resources. The question isn't, I don't think I could, and I'm not sure I could do that. And all, that's not the question. Kim told me, she says, well, I'm ahead of you. I'm starting Acts. She says, I have to say, I don't know anything about Acts. I've taught the kids Matthew a lot, but I don't know Acts. Maybe you'll have to teach her when we get to Acts. I said, oh, I can if you want me to, but I think you'll be fine. And she's ready to give it a try. It isn't a question of your strength and your strength. Will you trust, Lord, I'm with you always. The one thing I hope we do not do is be like Israel when they enter the land of Canaan. You remember the first chapter of Judges? God had told the Israelites, I want you to go into the land, I want you to drive them all out. And I mean it. Drive them all out. Don't make alliances with them. Don't do anything. Drive them all out of the land. I'm going to be with you. And what do you read in Judges chapter 1 that led to one of the most disgusting periods of history of Israel in the book of Judges? What happened? Judges 1:19. And they drove out the inhabitants of the mountains. But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. I could just see these Israelites, but Lord, I don't know if I could do it. They got chariots of iron, you know. Oh my. Chariots of iron? Did you forget the Egyptians? Did you forget what God did to the giants? But they got chariots of iron. And then, 1:27 of Judges. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean in its villages, or Taanach in its villages, or Dor in its villages, or Ibleam in its villages, and Megiddo in its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. Lord, we went and asked them if they would move, but they wouldn't. They were determined to stay. Like, we couldn't do it. Oh, give me a break. Is it any wonder in chapter 2 the angel Lord came to them and just went off on them? And then, look at this one. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains where they would not allow them to come down the valley. Oh my goodness. How embarrassing. You're the people of God and you let them drive you up and they wouldn't let you come down. Oh my. Amazing. Contrast that with 85-year-old Caleb. Now, folks, these are the days when you died at 110 years old, okay? Joshua died at 110 years old. This is not when the days when you lived to be 800 years old and 85 would be young. He's 85 years old, and here's what he says. He says, here I am this day, 85 years old. Now, therefore, give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day. For you heard in that day how the Anakim were there and that the cities were great and fortified. It may be the Lord will be with me and I should be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. He had spied out that land around Hebron. And he says, God said I could have it and I'm going to go get it. 85 years old, I'm going to still go get it. And look what it says. Hebron was therefore became the inheritance of Caleb. And the name of Hebron formerly was Kirjath-Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Translate giants. Then the land had rest from war. Oh, Caleb says, I'm going to go get that land. And that's that. God will be with me. And he whips the biggest giant around. 85 years old. Oh, it's because he was really good with the sword. No, it's because he had God with him, and he trusted God. Now, you might be thinking, well, you know, in the New Testament, that just doesn't happen that way. What does this verse say? Ephesians 3 and verse 20, 21. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly, abundantly, above. How many words does he have to use to try to convince us? Exceedingly, abundantly, above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. According to what? The power that works in us. To Him be glory in the church. That's us. To Him be glory, you see, because we reflect Him by going out and doing His will and sharing Him with others. To Him be the glory in the church by Christ Jesus throughout all ages, world without end. Amen. It isn't about our resources. That's where it begins. Everything from there on has to do with that. We're going to talk about how, simple ways that we can all do to participate. It's not going to have to do with going out and doing something scary, like knock on doors, or walk through malls and bump into people and try to attack them or something. So, you know, don't get scared. It's going to be simple things that everyone can do, that we can share the gospel. So I hope we be a part of that as we count on the Lord to help us. We're going to sing a song right now. And if there's any way we can help you in becoming a Christian,